Welcome to Mecha Do About Nothing, the only mecha podcast so culturally significant that you're required to do what it says. I'm your host, Ian Gregory.
And I'm your host, Daniel Forziat.
And this week, maybe a little belatedly, but we've done it. We've watched episodes 41 through 50 of Mobile Suit Gundam, Iron-Blooded Orphans, bringing our time with this series to an end.
It's over, Ian. We've done it. Another 50.
Another Monster Gundam series brought to a finish. Next up, 75 episode of Votoms.
Or what's that other one that everyone wanted us to watch? Dunbean? No, maybe not Dunbean.
Maybe. I mean, I want to watch Dunbean. I don't know. You're describing a lot of shows that people keep sending us that are like really long.
That are like, hey, I know 50 episodes is a lot, but this one's only 120. So like maybe when you get a chance.
Look, I've said it before. I'll say it again. If you really want us to watch something, if you send us an OVA, it is 100% guaranteed we will do it on the podcast within like a month. Like,
yeah. 50 episodes, not so much.
Yeah. Yes, so we're here. We're finally at the end of Iron-Blooded Orphans. It does feel like a long road because we had the holidays in between. We missed a week. Then this episode's coming out a little late because travel is hard and so is time zones.
Yes.
However,
a bit of miscommunication on my end, sorry.
But a bit of here. Miscommunication on my end. I was too busy playing Control to like notice what day of the week it was.
Dang, man, I could talk about Control. I've never even played it.
Dale, let's do a bonus episode on Control because I'm obsessed with that game now. I've just finished it.
Oh, really? Okay, so I haven't actually played it yet, but I played Quantum Break, so I feel like
So you're an expert. I'm a big Max Payne fan, the original two. Third one's
so we're cool. So we're here. We've got it. We've got the knowledge.
And I've played a bit of Alan Wake. I should maybe download that again. I have it on Steam, of course.
Yes, which is now redownloadable. I think
right,
there
was,
like, it was
off
licensing.
For a while for some reason. Sure.
Yeah. No, it's back.
All right. Anyway, maybe it says a lot about these episodes that we'd rather be talking about Remedy games, but Sam Lake, Wright Gundam. So, what is there to say about this? What's your overall feeling? I guess
I liked it. Wait. The episodes of the show.
For now, let's just talk about the episodes. In our final feelings, we'll have a lot to say about the overall show.
I think this is the best 10 episodes of season 2. I think.
Low bar.
Right. Yeah. Obviously. Or 10 episodes. Or maybe segment. Or whatever. But a lot of stuff happens. And there's a lot of really cool moments. I think there's some pretty flat moments as well that should have been awesome. But I really liked the general direction that this went. Mm-hmm. And a second time through, I still thought it was really entertaining. So I like them.
I do agree that there's a lot of moments here that are really good.
Yes.
Our highlights section is super long, and we're just going to use it to cover like stuff that we really liked that just aren't going to fit in. We have a crazy long discussion because you're right. So much happens that like all needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I have some dissatisfaction with the general execution of the themes. I think it leaves when you finish watching it, especially the first time, it will leave a very bad taste in your mouth for a long time. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
And I kind of want to talk about in our final section, so remind me about this. You posted the first episode of this. We were like, Iron-Blooded Orphans 1, you posted it on the Gundam subreddit. And you said something along the lines of like the best new Gundam for people to watch, which triggered like a 20 argument flame war or whatever.
People are like, I don't think you've seen this if that's what your opinion is.
A lot of people on the internet, extremely online people, really hate Iron-Blooded Orphans. Like, really have strong feelings about how this is a hot garbage show that's terrible and was ruined and no one should ever watch, etc., etc., and it's like a waste of your time. It's like you don't see that kind of intensity of hate for any other modern Gundam project, right? Even NT, which I thought was like kind of lukewarm, people are just like, eh. Thunderbolt, people love. Even 00, people don't have that much hatred for it.
I was gonna say, I have some spoilers for all of you guys. There is no like maybe it's just because we like Gundam a lot, but there's no legitimately like immaculate Gundam. All of them have like
extremely bad flaws. I feel
like everyone
agrees that there's no perfect Gundam series. I mean,
except for Unicorn.
Except for Zeta. Oh no, that was really telling. That was like the psychograph of this podcast. That's good. I think we just have to do the summary because there's so much to talk about. It's hard to like overview it because it's all so many different details.
Yeah, let's go into it.
All right. Mikazuki asks Atra to have a baby with him. Full stop. McMurdo Barristan takes in the remains of the turbines, and Jasly has Laughter gunned down in the mall. Tekkonen decides to go rogue and just kill Jasly, and everyone rejoices. Jasley tries to call McMurdo for help, but McMurdo reveals he's uncovered Jasley's plot to have him arrested by Eoch, and instead works something out with Rustle Elian in a secret backroom deal. Jasley then gets maybe the most obliterated anyone ever is in this show. It's all downhill from there. McGillis begins his revolution and Tekkaden joins him. They launch a coup at the Seven Stars headquarters and take everyone but Rustle and Eoch captive. McGillis activates the ancient Gundam Bile, which was piloted and has the soul of Agnika Kairu, and Gaelio reveals himself to McGillis but fails to stop him. Evidently, Bile is so culturally significant that everyone in Gjallarhorn has no choice but to follow McGillis, but basically no one does. Now Tekkaden and McGillis have to fight Rustle's massive Arianrod fleet in space. Tekkaden and McGillis get bopped, and Shino dies, and they're forced to retreat. They make it back to Mars, but the Tekkaden base is under siege from Gjallarhorn. Tekkaden is declared wanted criminals, but Cudelia says they can make new identities in the Arbrow database, and Makanai agrees to help because he's being weirdly charitable. Also, McMurdo decides to help them out, too, out of nostalgia and respect for Naze. Orga gets the remaining turbines to help them out, but then he is gunned down in the street by agents of Noblis Gordon. Remember him? Mika rallies the remainder of Tekkaden, and they begin to escape through underground tunnels while the pilots hold off Gjallarhorn. Mika and Akihiro remain on the battlefield so everyone can escape and die in the process. Gaelio and McGillis fight, and McGillis loses and then is shot to death by a tearful Gaelio. Finally, Tekkaden escapes. Time skip. Rustle Elian removes the Seven Star System, and his new policies end up being exactly what McGillis wanted. Mars is a free world and is flourishing, and now Cudelia is in charge. She ends up being a politician working alongside Rustle Elian to abolish the human debris system. Gaelio is recovering from removing the Alea Vinyana system, and he's getting along great with Julieta. Most of Tekkaden works either at the Admos Company, at the Orphanage, or for the Mars government, all under new identities. Right at the end, Ride shows up and murders Noblis Gordon on the toilet, and Cudelia visits Atra and Mika's kid.
Dang. So one thing I really do enjoy about this is they give us a substantial epilogue, which I feel like really can bring closure to.
This is a chunky epilogue. I mean, and the way this ends, you have to, because it's so not evident what's going to happen just at the end of the timeline. So that they have to show you. It's not like compared. I don't know. It's not like 0079, where it's like war is over, and you're like, oh, that's it. And this is like the war is over. You have no clue what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I was going to say, like, Awakening of the Trailblazer. It's like, cool, we defeated the aliens. Okay, now we've got, like, Metallic Setsuna. And it's what the heck? Right. So I like this one a lot. It was, like, very much, like, it gave me more closure the first time
I saw it. They do a good job of, like, catching you up on every single remaining character and what they're up to.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, like, the really cool ones, like Raido. So, blast the Noblis Gordon on the toilet.
Yeah, so let's do some highlights. First, Jasley Domo Niklos. So infuriating. One of the most annoying characters in season 2, alongside Eoch. Just like, has laughter killed, continues to be smug and awful. And then he's like, all right, now we just got to beat Tekkaden in open warfare because I'm an idiot.
Yeah, right.
Predictably, he loses horribly, tries to surrender. Orga is like, just kidding. I was never going to accept your surrender. I just wanted to watch you beg for your life, and it kind of sucked. And I don't know. It just feels so strange to me that, like, they're like, these guys, they've only got, like, Jassy's attitude seems to be that Tekkaden has only gotten by on luck so far. But, like, can you not just watch the tapes of Mika piloting? Like, it's pretty clear that they're on another level here in terms of combat ability. So it's like a nice moment of catharsis before everything goes to hell in the ending is, finally, Tekkaden's like, you know what? Screw the consequences. We're just going to kill Jasley. And unsurprisingly, McMurdo Barristan is fine with it because he hates Jasley too, because how could you not?
Yeah, that was a really good part.
Yeah. Related, I'm just going to keep going here. Epilogue, Death of Noblis Gordon. So Noblis, who you may remember, crucially decided to help Tekkaden in season 1 and broadcast that Cudelia speech, now turns against them and is broadcasting information about how they're wanted criminals and is doing information control so they can't tell anyone their side of the story. Then he makes a ton of money being an arms dealer with Gjallarhorn taking over Mars and then winning the revolt. And then, you know, even in the new world where things seem better, he's still really rich and gross and ugly. And so he goes to sit down on the toilet and someone knocks on the door and it's just Ride, who's been hunting him. Or, like, Noblis Gordon has been, like, staying away from Mars out of fear that he'll get killed, I guess. So he shows up, and sure enough, Ride just Mika's him, like, 3 times in the head on the toilet.
Oh, so good.
It's a good callback to all of the times Mika has done those, like, execution 3, like, double, triple tap in the head. Because that's exactly what Ride does here. And it, again, this is like such blatant catharsis, satisfaction. Like, oh, they killed a bad guy. I feel good. But it does feel good.
It does feel really good. I'm glad Rita got it too, because like, I mean, I guess we'll talk about when Orga gets got, but yeah,
oh my
he's
God,
like,
Rita is the Rita one who feels... needs to do that. Yeah.
But yeah, exactly.
I also just like the call out to Mika. Like that he's the one that they're all influenced by.
I agree.
Do you want to do one?
They kind of go in order, so you can go. You do yours next.
Oh, okay. This is like not a highlight, but it's a moment. So,
gosh, this part hurts my heart so bad.
They're in space and they're fighting Rustel Elian's Arianne Road Fleet, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, they're outnumbered like 4-1 or something. They're so outgunned, even with all their Gundams. And they have a single Dinesleaf for Shino's Gundam, because that's what his Gundam was built to do. They just weren't using it.
Yeah.
Like, people kept saying they were because, you know, unfairness. So Shino's like, here's what we do. Like, we basically shoot me to the front. I break through the picket line, just gun down Rustel Elian's bridge with the Dinesleaf. And, like, it's like a desperation cut off the head attack, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they do it. Shino gets there, lines it up. And then Julieta breaks away long enough to deflect the shot, and Shino misses by like 10 feet. Or, you know, he just skims the ship instead of nailing the bridge.
Oh my gosh.
Here's
the voice actor?
Yeah.
The voice actor for Shino.
Shino puts in the work in the dub in the sub. He's really doing his money's worth.
Dang. Dude, it like pulled my heartstrings, man. That's like the biggest disappointment of all time, because the first time you watch the show, you really don't know how it can go. Like, maybe Rustel actually does die there, but like, there's so many other antagonists that it could go any way, right? And it's just like, what can happen?
I never felt that Rustel was in serious danger there. It felt like there were too many episodes left. It felt too easy. But it is, they do a really good job making you believe it could happen. It's just a well-executed moment, and it's heartbreaking, and that ends with Shino dying, which is such a bummer, because he's probably one of the most unabashedly positive characters in the show.
Yeah, him and Eugene are, like, my favorites, because they're just, like, two boys hanging out, right? It's pretty cool.
And Eugene gets some good moments here, too.
Oh, I want to just put this out there. I don't know any time other to say this. Eugene's my favorite. I love Eugene. He's
underrated.
The best character.
Underrated Tekken boy. All right, Dan.
Okay, so this is, like, really cheesy, but also I sort of liked it because I like cheesy stuff. But when the Dinesleaf team fires on Mika and Akihiro and basically tears them apart, Mika does the thing where the Barbados eyes turn red, and then the Lupus Rex literally starts howling. It just starts, like, killing things and starts howling like a
wolf. I do believe I said something to you last week about how mobile suits sometimes make howling noises, and you were like, I don't know. Come on. It's literally the motif of the Lupus Rex, like, his weird animal noises.
I think it's stupid because it's sort of like...
It's tacky.
It's tacky, and, like, things are pretty well explained in this show, except for that. They're just like, okay, now let's make it howl. And it's like, all right, whatever.
It's the grinding of the gears. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's cool, though. You're right that it has an effect. Like, your next one's a good one, too.
Yeah, the next one is... Akihiro again is dying along with Mika in the same exact scene, and stupid Eok, who already was supposed to die to McGillis, which I was kind of
I was confused about that too, because he like attacks McGillis obliterates him, and then he just turns up a scene later.
Yeah,
and you're like,
so he's alive.
Yeah,
yeah, that's yeah, whatever. So
that's
he's alive, and he's like
continuity fixing,
and he's just like, everyone, like, let's rally. We can't lose morale. Excuse me. And Akihiro hears his voice. And again, that's another scene where, like, the voice actor is putting in some work. And he goes crazy. And he ends up just, like, crushing Eok as he dies. And it's like, oh,
because it looks
so
like Eok's about to kill him. And then Akihiro just whips out those scissors, man.
Yeah.
But what's really good, I really like the way I don't know how it is in the sub. I don't remember. But in the dub, Akihiro says, like, huh, I guess good things do happen to you if you live long enough. Because... all he wanted was Eok to show up so he could kill him. Gets his wish. I just like that Akihiro is literally dying, and he's like, this is great. That's a very Akihiro moment. It's like, this is all I want is my revenge. So, yeah, three of the more annoying characters, Jasly, Noblesse Gordon, and Eok, get pretty satisfying deaths in these episodes. Which
yes,
is it,
agreed.
A weird part of the ending is that, like, it ends badly, but then in the epilogue, like, everything is cleaned up. So, like, all the characters you like are alive, and all the characters you didn't like are dead. Like, of the remaining characters. Do you know what I mean by that? It's not like Jason yeah. survives and makes it big, or, like, Rustle Elliot, even though he's the villain, is not a hateable character, right? He doesn't do anything that you don't like. He's not mean. He's not even very snotty to Tekkonen.
Yeah, there's a few scenes where he's just like, or Juliet? What? Okay, Julietta. Her name of her mobile suit is like the same
the
as
Julia,
her name, right?
And her name is the Julietta or something. Who, yeah, Julietta, okay, by the way, whatever. Does not live up to her promise of her first scene where she eats that butterfly.
Yeah, she just becomes a boring character. But anyhow, she's like, man, I really feel bad for Tekken and everyone uses them. They had no good adults in my life. And then Rustle Elion's like, you realize I'm one of those sketchy adults you were talking about. Like, I'm one of those corrupt. And so, like, he does some bad stuff. Like,
he's not a good guy, and he's the villain yeah. here, or at least our antagonist. But he's self-aware, and he's not, like mustache-twirlingly awful in the same way Jastly is, or Noble
yeah,
Scorpion
that's true. That's true. Yeah.
But then,
okay,
like, all those characters who you just really are annoying in their way, Eok, Jastly, are dead or cleaned up or Noblest. They're all gone, right? So there's, like, a weirdness to this ending where it's, like, all the complicated stuff is gone. Anyway.
For sure.
I did like this moment where they're on the phone with Mach and I, who I guess decides he likes Tekkonen. Because if you remember in season one, he was super mercenary with them, where he's like, you have to do this for me or this will happen and you should do that. Like, you know, he was really manipulating them. Here he just does a bunch of stuff for free, which is kind of strange. Mm-hmm. But I think it's because he's getting older and he has nostalgia for them and he's like knows them all pretty well now.
And Dante saved him. Or Chad. Yeah, Chad saved
Chad
him.
Saved him. He does like Chad and he sees Cordelia as his like protege now. Mm-hmm. But it's just like pan over and it's Takaki.
Yeah.
Like, you were like, what's going to happen to Takaki if he's leaving Tekkonen? Will he find a job? And he's like, now Magenai's aide. That's nice. Good for him. He deserves it.
It is nice.
After like the horror that he was put through in the first 10 episodes of season two, I was pleased that he was relevant. And you've got this last one.
And my last one, and this goes back to my favorite Big Hands quote of all time, is Chad, of course, is like, yo, let's go drink Cordelia. And she's like, nah, I'm busy. I'm going to go home and see the family. And then I think it's Eugene is like, yeah, she's going back to the man who loves her or something.
It's the love of her life.
Yeah. And like, it, of course, it shows a silhouette of someone and it's got the Mikazuki hair, right? And you're like, oh, who could this be? And then it's
Akatsuki.
Mikazuki and Atra's child. And it's like, oh, okay.
I do
well.
Love the beat that's just like, let's have a baby. They don't mention it ever again. And then she's got his baby at the end.
Yeah. And then, of course, Cordelia says the really creepy thing. She's holding Akazuki and she's like, wow, you got big hands like your dad. She's like, what? Stop. Stop talking about his big hands, girl.
I'm sorry. I just love that his name is Akatsuki because it's just like the Naruto villains.
Like, also, it's like Atra and Mikazuki combined.
I'm hunting the tailed beasts. You're so cute, Akatsuki. all right, that's our highlights. We managed to do like 18 minutes of highlights.
Yeah, I know. This is going to be bad. This is going to be like an hour and 30 minutes.
This is a honker. This is what you get, 50 episode Gundam series, folks. So it's time for the ending. We're going to start with the end, right? Let's just survey this. So, first we've got the whole thing with getting rid of Jastly.
Yes.
That's the first plot. Jastly has Laughter murdered. It's ridiculously senseless, happens out of nowhere extremely fast, super telegraphed because she's doing all this romance stuff with Akihiro, who, hilariously, does not get it at all, of course.
You thought it was telegraphed.
I think
first time I watched this, I didn't think it was telegraphed. I thought they were writing her out of the show.
I get that. That's like the hint, but it's a little, and it was more sudden than I expected, but to have a character go around trying to confess her feelings to the person she loves, that's grade A Gundam Death Flag material, man. Like,
that's true. That is true.
So I felt her death was not satisfying. I was dissatisfied with how it played out. I just thought it was so sudden, and we're going to talk about this in Orga, too. It's like, sudden deaths are kind of a good thing. But also, I was just like, this felt so cheap in a way. That, like, Jastly's right. The best way to provoke Tekkonen was to kill Laughter. But it's kind of disappointing that the way to get Tekkonen to do something is just to kill the girl.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. And I think when we talk about Orga's death, let's talk about like sudden deaths as well. Because as you're right, I think they can be used sparingly, sort of like jump scares. But mm-hmm. if you do it too much, it just becomes like,
ooh, another character's dead. How do you feel? Like, are you frightened? Are you upset? Gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. It's a little too self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
This is a weird mix. All of our Gundam pilots are dead.
Yeah, all of them.
Shino dies. Akihiro dies. Mika dies. Mika goes out in a blaze of glory. Akihiro gets his revenge. Shino has the saddest death.
I think Shino's death the first time I saw it was the one that really like got me the most. Because I didn't expect him to live, but I didn't expect it to be that horrible.
Yeah.
Like, everything went horrible, and then he dies. And it's like, wow, that sucks a lot.
And Akihiro and Mika kind of get what they want when they die. Akihiro gets the revenge, and Mika is doing exactly what he wants to do, which is save Tekkaden, because he's being Orga mm-hmm. now. That's, like, Mika has a great moment after Orga's death, where he just gets up in front of the Barbados and just says, here's what we're going to do. Like, he takes over leadership, and it's a good moment for him to show, like, he's got that image of Orga that can still guide him.
And it's so unlike him, too, because he's never done anything like that before. And immediately after the speech, it, like, pans to Eugene. And that's, like, kind of supposed to be Eugene's job, right? He's, like, second mm-hmm. in command. But he sort of accepts it. He's like, yeah, like, well, he's totally going to give that role to Mikazuki because...
like, Eugene is still the one who's, like, running operations, but Mikazuki is the leader in a way.
Like, yeah, exactly.
And it makes... I mean, Mikazuki is the symbol of Tekkaden, basically, or the Barbatosis. Mm-hmm. So... that's at least a good moment. It's kind of interesting that all the Gundam pilots end up dead. And McGillis, who pilots a Gundam, who else has a Gundam?
Oh, Galio.
No, I don't think, is the Vidar a Gundam?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, because they take the totally armor is off the and Gundam it becomes Vidar. The Kimaris. Yeah.
You're right, it's the Kimaris that becomes the Vidar. So he's the only Gundam pilot left alive? Is that right?
I guess so?
That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yes. I don't have much to say about Galio.
I wonder what that is. Galio is the only Gundam pilot to survive. It says something interesting about how, like, Gundams are cursed machines. They're demons machines.
Oh, and everyone ends up dying with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or they have bad ends. I mean, Mika becomes a demon, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. Where he does the full acceptance thing with it, where he just goes ballistic. Great moment.
Yes.
Real quick, if we're talking about Shino, they textually, literally, in the show, say Yamagi was gay and liked Shino.
Yes.
Mind-blowing to me that they would do such a thing. Not because I just do not expect Gundam to actually say that. But then, of course, nothing comes of it because Shino dies immediately, so it's a bummer. But mm-hmm. I just want to like make a moment to say, like, oh my god, they actually said explicitly that he's gay, which is still something mm-hmm. that a lot of anime don't do. They just hint at for the shippers. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything to say about it, but it's kind of a bummer that that's how it plays out, but whatever.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I can't really like relate because I'm not gay, but I thought it was handled pretty well. Like, they didn't force it and make it like a weird thing like they did in Gargantua on the Virtuous.
Yeah, it's not a gag. It's not like a weird icky thing, and it's not funny that I saw people on Twitter recently talking about how much they like Gargantua, and then someone replied and it's like, except for that one weird episode, and everyone else was like, yeah, that was awful. And they were all talking about that episode.
Yeah.
What even are they?
Cross dressing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The weird homophobia stuff. So but at the same time this show. But also nothing comes of it, so it kind of doesn't mean anything.
That's the other thing. Like, I don't know if, like, if you are gay and you look at this, does it feel tacked on? I can't.
I do respect that say, this is something that understand. They hinted at from you know, it's they this is Yamagi and Shino is something they've hinted at from the very beginning of those characters. Mm-hmm. So, like, I respect that they not only hinted at it, but they paid it off in a way that was very explicit. Because a lot of shows would do all that hinting and then not explain it.
Yeah, right, where it's just like, maybe they were, but they're too much of a coward to say, like, yes, they were gay, you know?
All right, we gotta talk about Orga's death, though.
Oh boy, here we go.
So, do a little more scene setting.
Yes.
They go to the Admos Company headquarters through the tunnels. They sneak out. so that they can increase so that they can like make the call to Makanai, right?
Yes.
And they're there and they're like, all right, our plan's gonna work. We did it. They step outside to get back into the tunnels to go home. A car pulls up, three dudes roll down the windows and shoot at Ride. Orga jumps in front of him and holds Ride to protect him. Mm-hmm. Orga gets shot like 20 times, pulls out Mika's gun because Mika's like, here's my gun. It's like the gun that you gave me. Make sure you bring it back. Oh my God. Stop telegraphing these things, anime writers. Then Orga does just like headshot a dude from 50 yards away. And then they drive off and Orga's like, told you I was a good shot. And then he like stands up dramatically, is framed by the setting sun or whatever. And he's like, now we've just got to fight forward, and dies.
Yeah, I mean, so I think this death would have been better if Laughter's death wasn't a sudden death as well.
Laughter's death is structurally almost identical the way it happens.
Yeah, and that's why I think this feels awful, because it's like, cool, they're randomly talking. Because I knew this was going to happen, right? We knew when it was going to happen. And so I was paying especially close attention to how they telegraph it. And you're right. The only thing that super telegraphs it is the Mikazuki gun part. So
it's just so lame.
Well, no. I think they might use the same music, too. So they're walking out to the car, and it starts playing really lighthearted music, and they're talking about the future and how everything is going to be great. And then, of course, that horrible thing happens where they get shot up.
Where it's too tonally one direction, so that you know something's going to happen, yeah.
But I just, yeah, if they would have just done Laughter differently, like written her out or something, because all of Tewaz becomes basically really irrelevant after that. I mean, like in terms of like actual screen time. If they somehow just like did something different with Laughter and then did this with Orga, I think it would have been much more impactful, because you don't expect the main character of your show, the main leader, to just get gunned down randomly at the end of an episode, right? And I think that could be powerful, but we saw it already.
We did. And, I mean, respect to the show for having, like, Orga's death be... I mean, the complete sudden senselessness speaks to, like, the tactics of Noblesse Gordon and the enemy.
Yes.
That I like this thing that we really get hammered home is that Tekkonen is a frontline fighter. They're open ground fighters. They're great at war. They don't do the trickery thing very well. They don't do politics backstabbing. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like, it'd be best for us to backstab McGillis, but that's just not how we do things. Like,
yeah.
So I'd like to see them get taken advantage of this way. They're just not playing the same game as their enemies. They're there to fight wars and survive, not to, like, seize power, which maybe is why they fail, is because Orga tries to make them do something they aren't meant to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Of Mars.
Yes.
But, so I like that this is how he dies. I hate that this is how he dies.
Yeah.
Because it just happens, right? And it's, again, it's lame because we've seen it, and it feels like they're like, oh, this trick worked with Laughter. I guess we'll just do it again.
Yeah. So weird. This is completely irrelevant, and you probably don't have the answer to this, but anime like this is not made, it's not made weekly, right? It's made in batches. Not batches, but it's made ahead of time.
No, my understanding is this is... So, almost all my knowledge of how actual anime production takes place is from Shirobako. There are columns online and people online who know everything there is to know about the production of anime, like, and so on, especially mech anime.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is, with a show like this, you don't actually... You are producing these episodes, like, several weeks before they actually air. But you are producing them episode by episode, or, like... Or, like, several episodes are in production at one time. And, like, pretty much not live, but you know what I mean. Like, these are not done, and then they air all 25.
Okay.
They will air, like, they'll have, like, five done.
And then they'll air. Like, yeah, they'll be working on episode 6 while episode 1 is airing.
Yeah, because their schedules are so ridiculously tight.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to Japan.
And they have such little money, even Sunrise. So, like, yeah.
Yeah, where it's, like, crazy, like... Because I know manga artists like basically just work every day of their lives.
I mean, the weekly turnaround time on weekly Shonen Jump manga is like horrendous.
Yeah, yeah. It
wrecks havoc on your body.
You might get like a Sunday evening to yourself, and that is it. That is the extent of your time off.
I think it was Oda, who does One Piece, posted his weekly schedule one time, and he straight up gives himself like 6 hours a week to do whatever. And then the rest of it is like, he gets like 4 hours, 5 hours of sleep, and the rest is like research, writing, storyboard, like penciling, backgrounds, editing, redraws, submissions. And Oda is producing the single biggest manga in the history of the art form.
Yeah.
And he probably has a billion assistants and so on, and he's still on that schedule.
Yeah, because I remember that the same thing happened to Tite Kubo, the guy who made Bleach. And like towards the end of it, it literally ruined Bleach. He's like, he's like, the schedule is actually why Bleach is awful. Like, I couldn't do it.
I mean, and if you look at people like Togashi, who did Yu Yu Hakusho, you know, mega hit when Yu Yu Hakusho was coming out, worked like crazy. Now he's doing Hunter Hunter, mega hit.
Oh wait, that's the same guy? Dang, I didn't know.
And you know who his wife is? Is the creator of Sailor Moon.
That's actually,
I think, like, her name is Naoko Takeuchi. I know, it's like a super marriage. He's working on Hunter x Hunter, but he's so sick and like he really crashed his health in the 90s that Hunter x Hunter goes on these crazy 6 month hiatuses because he's just like can't move from his bed to draw. Does is he'll like work up a 10 issue block. They'll release it in Jump, like enough for one volume, Tankobon volume, and then like he'll go on hiatus again.
Dang.
So this schedule, I don't know why this is related, but yeah. That schedule is horrendous.
Okay. Anyhow, I'm glad we got to talk about that.
Are you saying that maybe they saw the reaction to the laughter episode and...
Thank you for bringing that around, Ian. Because
Is that what you're thinking?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Because there is enough time speculating, of course.
It's like 6 or 7 episodes. That's pretty tight. But I think what may have happened is they're storyboarding the end and they need to figure out how to make certain things happen. And they start pulling tricks they've already done because they need to get to the end because they're on a schedule where they don't have time to say, what's a better way to make Orga die? What's a better way to have this happen? Let's just do the thing we know works.
And you can't have Orga die in a battle, right? He's not, like...
He doesn't do battles.
He doesn't do battles. And he almost already got killed by Carta Issue sort of in a battle, like in a skirmish. So it's like, how else does he die, right? And he's not with any enemies right now. So like, does Rustle Elian come shoot him? No. So, yeah, no, I guess that makes sense, right?
That's not how Rustle Elliot operates at all. It makes sense for Rustle to have Noblesse Gordon do it, though.
Yes, that is true.
Noblesse to kind of just do it on his own, because, like, Noblesse has to tell Rustle he did this, and Rustle's like, that's fine, I guess.
Yeah, Rustle's like, okay, cool. Yeah, that's a good point.
And then that's why Ride is the one to kill Noblesse in the epilogue, is because Ride really blames himself for Orga's death, because Orga was shielding him. Orga's death. Mixed feelings about it. It had to happen, but I'm not sure if I just like the way it was executed.
I agree with you.
All right. Here's where we get into the real beef I have. The way Fireblooded Orphans ends.
In what character?
In the end, it didn't even matter. Like, all right. Rustle Elian. McGillis dies.
Yes.
The rebellion's a total failure. Rustle Elian is like the clear leader of Gatherhorn. He's the one who saved them all. The other 7 stars, there's like no other family. You know, he's the guy.
Yes.
Obviously, he seizes control of Gatherhorn. No one argues. Now Gatherhorn is just as popular and successful as they were at the beginning of season 1.
Yes.
Because you remember at season 2, they were weakened because of Tekadon. Now, they're big shots. And what he does with that power is literally everything McGillis wanted to do. He abolishes the 7 stars family system to make it more of a straight meritocracy or like military, not meritocracy, but military organization. So there's no nobles anymore. Or at least there are nobles, but they don't have that power.
Yeah. They might just be figureheads.
He releases Gallarhorn's ownership of Mars and just gives it to the people. And then Koudelia gets elected, which is basically what McGillis was going to do with Tekadon. Or at least McGillis was going to give Mars to Tekadon, and Tekadon would probably just have Koudelia do everything because that's how they operate.
Exactly.
Like, and then he gets rid of human debris, which is admittedly not a Gatherhorn thing. They don't use human debris.
Yes.
But Gatherhorn could have gotten rid of human debris at any point in the last 200 years if they felt like it. So my problem here is Rustle Elian is our antagonist for this season. What does he actually want? We never learn what his goals were, what his plans were if he became in charge of Gatherhorn. He just shows up and is like introduced as the guy who's in the way of McGillis and total control of Gatherhorn. We never know what he wants, and then he gets in charge and he turns out to do like everything that we wanted him to do, and everything works out fine and dandy.
Yeah, and
what?
So I talked about this a bit before with Jasley, where I was like, if Jasley was just in season 1, I would maybe care, like, not care about him, but, like, be more okay with his character. And it's the same with Russell Ellion. Like, the fact that Russell Ellion appears out of nowhere in season two, along with the rest of the Seven Stars, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, again, has no background and has no... has nothing. We literally don't know anything about him. And now all of a sudden, like, we find out that really, I guess Tekadin and McGillis were the bad guys because Russell Ellion was just trying to make things better in the world. It's like, so.
Yeah, but was he like...
Or what, did he only because Tekadin and McGillis put him...
made those ideas popular? Like, yeah, exactly. I'm going to talk about that later when we get to the Gundam theme section. The point is, Russell Ellion, extremely weak antagonist.
Yeah, not good.
Can we do a rundown of some... Gundam antagonists real quick.
Char count?
Well, no, let's start with like the big bad runs the enemy organization.
Gieren Zabi.
What does Hitler. Gieren Zabi want?
He's Hitler.
Freedom for all space noids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But like Hitler freedom for space noids.
Oh, yeah.
Clear goal on this dude, right?
Yeah. Wants
he's
power.
Evil, but we know what he wants.
Yeah, he wants power, obviously.
Captimus Shirako, similar thing. Wants to take control of the Titans.
Haman.
What's interesting is that, yeah, you're right. Tekadin and McGillis are occupying the traditional role of the villains. They want to do something, right? They want to take control of Gjallarhorn.
Oh,
and Russell Ellion is all that stands in their way. In the traditional, like, anime protagonist-antagonist, the antagonist is the one with desires, and the protagonist has values that they use to stop the antagonist, right?
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah.
I'm really suspect of this theory, but I have read in an article that this has something to do with Buddhism and how desires is bad and only villains have desires and how anime protagonists just have values. Like, typically in like shonen, it's like, no one should die and I support my friends. I think that's kind of racist nonsense, but it is true that there is a trend in a lot of anime where it's like, Shiro Emiya just wants to make everyone be happy and no one to die. Right.
That is a good point.
Naruto just wants, like, but it also doesn't make much sense because when you look at shonen anime, it's like Naruto wants to be Hokage, Luffy wants to be King of the Pirates.
Yeah.
But that said, like, when you go further back, Goku doesn't have any desires.
Yeah, Goku just exists. And then Bulma's like, hey, that's like, come find these balls with me.
Yeah, but, and in Z, it's just like, villain shows up, Goku's like, who's like, I'm going to blow up the world, and Goku's like, nah.
He's like, my friends live here.
It's a reactive formula. I think Gundam tends to occupy reactive formulas. So Zeon wants to like, you know, seize control. We're opposing that. Paptimus Shirako and the Titans want to seize control. Resisting that. What's the third one? Double Zeta, who cares? Char's counterattack. Char is going to drop.
Like, physically, Char is trying to push something in a direction, and they're trying to stop it.
Well, even in Double Zeta, Haman wants to do something, and we're trying to stop Haman.
Yes.
Like, that is the trend, I think. The exceptions being probably 00, which changes because in season two of 00, we're back to the resistance.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Structure. What else? I'm trying to think of all the Gundam shows I've seen.
Build Fighters,
man.
It's
different with the OVAs.
Just kidding. Build
Fighters. Stardust Crusader. Stardust Memory.
Oh, is this a JoJo podcast? I'm just kidding.
Stardust Memory, though, similar concept.
Yeah.
The Zeon Remnants want to do something. We want to stop them. I think that's a traditional Gundam framework for our protagonists. We have the reversed here, and that's fine, but the problem is that the goals of our antagonists are not at all clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
In 00, where we have our protagonist being like, I'm going to go do this thing to stop war, we also get long shots of Ribbons being like, this is all part of my plan, which is all part of Aeolia Schenberg's plan, which is that everything is part of Aeolia. You know, but...
Yeah.
We see what they want. In this, we just don't have that, and it's a real bummer because it means that this conflict is so senseless.
Mm-hmm.
It's my rant.
It's okay. It was a good rant. I agree, and it made me think. Ian, it provoked thought.
And that's what we're here for.
Thoughtful discussion.
All right. Next beef. McGillis Farid.
Who has an episode named after him. I believe it's like 49.
Here's McGillis's plan, right? Step one, kidnap all the Seven Stars leadership. Solid plan if you're planning a revolution. I'm down. That's how you do it, right?
Yeah.
Step two, get all these young officers who believe in your ideals to lead a revolt. Word. But we're still up against bad numbers. Here's how I'm going to turn it around. Step three, get in a Gundam, and then everyone will just do what I say because of magical rules? Question mark?
Like, I kind of, okay, so in a way it sort of makes sense, because think about this. We've been told this entire time that Gjallarhorn is very corrupt, right? Gjallarhorn is corrupt, blah, blah, blah. They have these archaic ideals.
Traditional.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so when you incorporate something like Bale and you say, hey, you have to listen to me because I have Bale, and the fact that they sort of do, and I mean, I'll explain it. So he brings out Bale and the rest of the Seven Stars members that aren't dead or in his custody.
Restel.
Are like, hey, listen, we acknowledge that you have Bale and we acknowledge what that means. But because we hate you, we're just going to stand off to the side and take all of our forces off to the side.
And McGillis's plan was to then co-opt their entire army
yes.
to defeat Rustle.
Which would make the numbers way more even, yes.
And weirdly, this gets lampshaded because Orga is like, your plan is to do what? And all these random Gjallarhorn people are like, they're just some things you don't understand if you're not a part of Gjallarhorn. But turns out, even if you're a part of Gjallarhorn, that doesn't matter. Like,
yeah.
And then once Rustle wins one fight, they're like, battle doesn't matter, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all this nonsense about how Bile has the soul of Agnica Cairo.
Okay, well, that stuff
first sounds poetic. At first, you're like, oh, it's a poetic thing. Then it turns out that literally, like, his brain is in the computer or something.
I really don't know.
Completely unexplained, yeah. And that's really dumb. Really frustrating stuff. Plus, sorry, we had to throw this in there because I can't not address it. Also, all that weird stuff with his fucking 6-year-old bride. I know we try not to swear in this podcast, but it's disgusting.
This
whole plan is hot garbage. McGillis makes no sense.
Ugh. Can I actually talk about the 6-year-old bride thing?
Yeah, lay it on me, dude.
Because I'm here for the controversial things. No, trust me, this will be an unedited podcast. You hear it first. Actually, we have to have an edit. Spoilers. I think that the thing he did was sort of okay here because he captured, what's his name? What's the older Bodwin? The father. Mr. Bodwin. Because he captured Mr. Bodwin. He needs someone, if this plan goes through, he needs a Bodwin to essentially be part of him.
Puppet
that family, right? And so it makes sense where he's like, listen, you can't kill yourself because I literally need you alive for this. So I actually kind of liked that in the sense that if you look at it from that perspective where McGillis is actually just like truly evil and is trying to take over this family, it's in a sense, it's not like the way I saw it wasn't like a disturbingly sexual pedophile way. It was just extremely creepy. Yeah, he's just using a 6-year-old. Oh, she's not 6.
Manipulating.
She's like what? She's 12. 10, yeah. Yeah.
Who knows?
So in the sense that I kind of and he like messes her up.
He really ruins her life.
Yeah.
that girl needs therapy. Like, holy cow.
And I feel
bad for her.
And I think that's kind of well done though, in the sense that like, yeah, it sucks for her. I mean, she's a fictional character, but in a way it shows that like you can really mess people up by like manipulating them and like using them and stuff like that. Because when we get that little,
I kind of wish we could see her in the epilogue. Like, how's she doing?
Well, what if she was like in an asylum or something, like mental health? Not asylum, but you know what I mean, like a mental health care facility. It's like, oh, trying to get over herself. She's like in a straitjacket.
I think maybe the best point about McGillis is something Rustle says, where he's like, McGillis wants to tear down the Gjallarhorn system, right?
Yeah.
But he's doing so by manipulating the corrupt families, becoming a part of that system, and relying on flaky legends not at all based on history. All of the things he criticizes is the basis of McGillis' plan.
Okay, I actually have a counterpoint for that. I actually think McGillis is doing this too by the book. So I feel like McGillis was like, I have to fix the system. How can I do this? And he sees like the loophole that is Bale, but that's still part of the system. So yeah, while he like tries to like take over these family, he's trying to do it by the books. And then you look at Russell Ellion, who goes, I'm just going to use these illegal weapons and murder you all, right? And that's actually like completely off, right? Because McGillis could do the same thing. He could just get Dineslaves and fire, but he's like, no, I'm trying to somewhat do this. And maybe he's at a disadvantage because he needs to come into power in a way that is just, seemingly just. So that way when he has the power, he doesn't have like a bunch of rebels. Does that sort of make sense? It needs to be sort of vindicated.
Rustle already has the power of the establishment on his side, so if he does something awful, it's just another awful thing Gjallarhorn has done. And he doesn't have to justify himself as much. I do like that it does play into that recurring theme that people are just playing different games. You're right, McGillis is playing by the books. He's like, sees the tradition, he idolizes Agnica Cairo. And Rustle is playing real politics. He knows these dudes. He's got his soldiers. He does the math, and he's just gonna dine slife him from orbit. Like,
mm-hmm.
I really like that. Rustle's just playing a whole different game and one that's way more real.
Yeah, and that's exactly why when they finally encounter each other, McGillis gets absolutely blown out.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. All right. I just wish that McGillis had, like, more of a plan. In combination with his flaky plan, in combination with Rustle Elian's, like, vague characterization. Like, he's character, but we don't know what his goals are as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things in combination make this final confrontation, I think, really unsatisfying.
Agreed. I agree with that.
Minor beef here. This is the last thing to talk about real quick before we move into the last section here. People keep not knowing who Tekkaden is.
Yeah.
Like, especially in the post thing, they're like, Tekkaden, who was that? Or like, they frayed from memory. I feel like this was a significant event in history.
Yeah.
A lot of people died. It's the first major internal Gjallarhorn rebellion that led to major reforms. Like, Cordelia Aina Bernstein, who is a major political figure, literally the ruler of Mars. How can you not know who Tekkaden is if you're in relation to her? It just feels like this weird thing where they keep not knowing how famous to make these characters.
Yes.
And they keep walking it back. Sometimes they get recognized, sometimes they don't. It just didn't make much sense to me.
And yeah, there's like that scene at the end where Rustle and Cordelia are talking.
Cordelia.
And it's like that's the only point where you know that he knows all about Tekkaden. Like, they know completely about each other's pasts, right?
Well, yeah, I really actually like that, because he's scene. Like, I'm glad I could work with you on this issue, and they're being recorded, so she has to sort of speak around it. But she's like, you know, a couple years ago, I had a lot of friends who were really, really close friends who were human debris. And it's like a good moment where you know Rustle gets the weird kind of implicit threat there, which is like, I was a part of Tekkaden.
Yeah.
And, but he also knows he's not going to say anything, because what good does it do to him?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but what's weird is that evidently made no sense to the people listening.
Mm-hmm.
At home aren't like, oh yeah, you know, Cordelia was like, worked with Tekkaden to get to Earth for those half-metal reforms. Like, or like, those are key parts in like, where did this leader of Mars come from? You have to talk about Tekkaden. So it's mm-hmm. weird to me that that's something that no one cares about anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Minor beefs, though. Okay. Anyway, I just felt like, it sort of is a mess of motivations and actions that are really don't add up to what I would like it to add up to. The math doesn't work, in my opinion.
It's okay. You can be disappointed. You're allowed to have an opinion, Ian. You don't have to love every single mecha show we watch. I know you do.
Oh, I don't.
I know you do. But you don't have to force that upon yourself.
So let's we talked about this in the very first episode of Iron Blooded Orphans. Gundam theme time. It's time to come back to them.
Yes.
War is bad. Once again, we have more of a conventional war here.
Yes, the second
than
season
we did in
more.
The beginning.
Yeah.
But it's more, it's like a weird revolt. There's very few civilians involved in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
In that it takes place, you know, in space just between fleets, which is like fleet battles is interesting because it is doesn't take place in a zone that is being used by civilians. So it's like a different kind of war than we're used to
mm-hmm.
as earthbound earthnoids.
Yeah, as an earthnoid so, myself.
But for me, the take is like, weirdly, it focuses not on capitalism like the first series did. The first season really spends a lot of time talking about workers and revolts and mm-hmm. like reforms and how unfair it is that they're being suppressed.
And just oppressed classes
season
in general.
Two,
yeah.
Yeah. Season 2 backs away from that super hard. That is not a thing that comes up again, really. Mm-hmm. The plight of the common person. And now it's kind of like, is revolution bad? It failed and didn't make anything better for them. And like, they were doing it for a bad person. But then also, the changes that they wanted came about anyway. So is revolution pointless? Because if you work through the system, you'll get those changes. Or is the point, like you said earlier, that because they had this revolution, Rustle Elian had to make these changes because they popularized those ideas or changed the way everyone was thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. And we'll never know.
It's just, I don't know, it's just a very complicated, it's an interesting adjustment to the framework.
It is.
Unfortunately, like I said, the absolute blank slate that is Rustle Elian's motivations make it impossible to assess what the show is trying to say here.
Yeah.
It's just a total garbled mess.
Yes, exactly.
So I think that theme is a bit of a wash.
Oh, wait, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think the show would be like if Tekkaden won? Like, how could that?
Great question.
How could that show?
If we get the happily ever after, like.
Like, but.
I mean, it totally could work.
Yes.
It's what you expect to happen in a way.
Yeah.
I think this show is right that they should lose, because I do think it leads to more interesting questions than them just winning a fight and then, like, making things better because they're heroes. Mm-hmm. That's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it misses the execution on explaining everything else in this show. So, like, I think if you have them lose, you need to make it clear, like, what they were up against.
Yeah.
And so I think it's obvious what happens if they win, and that's not fun. That's not interesting.
In my little headcanon, I don't think McGillis can be a leader of Gjallarhorn. So I want to, like, I imagine they kill Rustle Elian at, like, episode, like, 45. And they're like, ah, oh, nah, this McGillis guy's bad. So Tekkadin's got to kill McGillis with the help of, like, Galio. And then Galio is, like, the head of Gjallarhorn.
That's a fairly good pull, actually. I could see that happening. McGillis. But I can also see McGillis seizing control of Gjallarhorn and Gjallarhorn just collapsing. He doesn't take control of it. It just vanishes, right?
Yeah.
Like, it just
falls
apart instead of him taking it. Like, it doesn't survive the revolution. That's another interesting way they could have a Pyrrhic victory.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I'm not sure how they do the full McGillis heel turn without him, like, turning insane when he gets power, which is incredibly lame.
Yeah, so, which is, like, kind of what has to happen.
The one thing we can say about McGillis is he is for sure on board with Tekkadin. He, like, likes them and will help them and is not intended to betray them.
Yeah.
And he goes out of his way to support them, even though he knows it'll mean his own death. So, like, it is a major part of his characterization that he's being honest. But that's also kind of strange because he's such a deceptive person in the first season that he becomes super straight-laced and honorable in the second season. What's up with that?
And they do a part two where what you're saying is, like, right, where basically Orga's like, hey, man, we're done here. We're not helping you anymore. We're trying to get out. And he goes, well, that sucks. Mm-hmm. Like, he tried to manipulate him. He's like, well, that's not the Tekkadin I would have known, blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, nah, seriously, this isn't going to work. And he goes, well, anyhow, I'm going to make a huge, like, distraction tomorrow. I guess you can, like, escape during that time. And you're like, okay, so he's being nice, right? And then he turns around right before he leaves and goes, no, because if you escape, actually, you're going to help my cause more. And it's like, what? That doesn't make any sense.
It just feels like McGill is trying to get the last word in the discussion. And he knows he's lost.
Yeah. I'm just like, okay. So I feel like, I don't know. I think they did McGillis a little dirty, but that's just,
he
I like
way better as a Char clone trying to bring about revolution than he does in this version where he's like more, or not bring about revolution, where he's like got all his agenda, right? He's doing the Char thing where he's assassinating key figures and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Then he does here where he's doing the Char thing where he's like trying to Neo-Zeon it.
Like, yeah.
I just think it doesn't work as well.
Agreed.
All right. The other theme, dude, new types. Everyone's got an Alea Vinyana by the end of the series. Okay, wait. I do have to give them some credit. So, Vidar, being Gaelio,
mm-hmm.
probably, they don't even try to disguise that reveal. It's super obvious it's Gaelio. It's Gaelio. No one's shocked. The real twist is that it's also Ayn.
That is really cool, actually. Where he just, like...
That's well done.
He's like, there's someone else here with me. And then Mikaela's like, what? And he goes, Ayn! And it, like, plugs in. That's actually a really sick scene. Nope.
Yeah. I have to give them credit for that. Not expected the first time you see it. It's good. It's a good call out. Mm-hmm. And it makes Vidar way more interesting. The engineer going, he's never been alone the entire time he's here. How does she know? Anyway.
Yeah. And I also like how they remove it. It's implied that they remove Ayn in the end.
Which raises the question, was that always something that was possible?
I don't know. Yeah, because again, Galio's just like hanging out at a hospital and he's just got the thing wrapped around his neck.
In a wheelchair with Julieta.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, obviously we wouldn't know because none of the Tekkadin characters wanted it removed because it was their livelihood. But like, was that always a thing you could do?
And I guess like if it's implanted in you and it didn't kill you, then like, it's literally just a benefit. So, yeah, you would never get it removed.
Yeah. And then, oh my god, here's the thing I hate the most. McGillis reveals that he went and found a way to get around the egg restriction on the Alea Vinyana, and he just got one off screen, and now he's got it, and that's how he can pilot bile, because you need one to pilot bile. And he's like, oh, the irony that Gjallarhorn hates human modification, but to pilot their god machine, you need it. And then, like, Rustle tells everyone that you need Alea Vinyana, and they all decide they hate McGillis. It's literally just like, by the way, I found a way around that thing that we talked about so much in season one and in the beginning of season two with Hush. Anyway, moving on.
I like it too, because part of me just was like, the writers are like, how can we get McGillis to take his shirt off? Like, how can we get this boy to, like, really show us what's under there, right? And they're like,
what's
if we
packing?
What? Because that's the best part, is he gets inside of Bail, and he's wearing, like, of course, like, the full Gjallarhorn jacket, like, uniform, and then he's just, like, ripped, as everyone is in this show. He's just absolutely just, like, shredded under there, and he's like, let's go, Bail. It's like, okay. I didn't have too much of a problem with it, because they sort of like kind of retcon it a little, where he's like, I was experimenting on iron the whole time, and that's how I figured it out. And it's like, I guess the evidence is there. Sure, why not? Whatever.
But like, what are they trying to say here? It just gets so garbled, because I said this earlier, I'm saying garbled a lot, but it does. It's just such a mess of theming. Like, what's the point of any of this? What is the Ilya Vanyana before was all about? The exploitation of orphans to make them into machines of war. That was the framework we had for it in season one. In season two, it's...
And then it was sort of like everyone, all the Gundam pilots in the Calamity War used them to fight the mobile armors. And now Gjallarhorn doesn't want people to have them because it's inhuman. It's inhuman, and it's like a remnant of the Calamity War that they're trying to erase and cover up. Evidently, because they censor a lot of stuff, like the whole mobile armor thing, everything. They censor it. So they're like trying to get away from that, because maybe, I guess, because that's the problem. We don't know.
Plus, I mean, I hated that whole mobile armor thing. Total wash. Means nothing in the longer
term. Oh, no, it doesn't mean anything. It literally doesn't mean anything.
I was so ready. I was like, oh, they're gonna, like, first time I saw this, I'm like, oh, they're gonna do something real cool, where like, it turns out they're going to accidentally unleash a mobile armor, or like someone's going to secretly have a mobile armor as their secret weapon, or it's going to be the plan to do this thing to like frame someone. Like, I thought it was all going to come back to like, how are we going to overcome these impossible odds, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll just let a mobile armor loose in the Ariane Road fleet, like, or something like that. They were going to use that weapon of mass destruction that was heavily foreshadowed and was shown to be horrifying. Absolute means nothing.
Yep.
Ugh. So, it feels so wasted.
And, like, even, like, there's, like, beam weapons and stuff. It's like, oh, cool, beam weapons are cool. Like none Gone. Of that. It's just, like, it was literally, like, those four episodes. That's it. It was over. Yeah. Just those four episodes.
And then we just got Dine Sleeps instead, which are interesting. It's fine, but, like, ugh. All right.
Mm-hmm.
We're running long. We got to get to the mech corner, Dan. There's only two things here.
I don't have much to say about either of these two things.
Gundam Bile.
I think Gundam Bile looks so stupid, actually.
So how do I describe this thing? It's all white with purplish highlights.
Well, I would say they're more blue, but...
Purple, blue, yeah. Yellow. Obviously, it's got the yellow and red. It's got, like, a V-fin with a command horn also. It's pointy. It's boring as boring can be.
I just don't like the way it looks. It seems like it's something out of, like, Full Metal Panic.
It just is boring. It's so boring. It's just got a sword.
Yeah. I don't like it.
They like amp up this super legendary cool machine, and it just looks like nonsense. It just looks bad.
I mean, it does have a little bit of time to shine when, and I'm not going to talk about how ridiculous this is, but McGillis single-handedly fights like 90% of the Ariane Rod fleet by himself in space, and somehow does like very well. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I mean, it looks cool when it's fighting there, but that's like the only time we see it ever fight.
And like, look, I'll give you some credit. It looks cool in the 1-100 with a nice build.
Yeah, the HG looks awful though.
Yeah, it's just the 1-100 looks pretty good.
Uh-huh.
All right, next up,
Barbatos Lupus Rex.
Barbatos Lupus Rex.
Oh,
this is the
King of Wolves.
This is the final version of the Barbatos. I like this thing.
It's really cool. I like it too. The tail is cool.
Big. Its arms are huge. It's got big old claw hands. It's got like feet. And the tail is ripped out of that mobile armor.
Yeah.
And it does this autonomous thing that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
The way it fights is horrifying and up close and scary. It's got like a really complicated, like jagged crown sort of V-fin style thing.
Yeah. Crown is a good way to put it.
Perfect for Mika's style.
Mm-hmm.
I am a fan of this. I'm a fan of how when it enters evil mode, it just turns full mobile armor, basically, where it's practically autonomous and just kills everything.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, is boring? I mean, it's not boring. It's just like, it's not even there for that long, and that's it. It doesn't get used very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything else? No, I mean, we've talked about Barbados like 20 times. We can let this one die, you know what I'm saying? Little wink there for you, because it's dead. He dies. He dies at the end.
Thank you, Daniel.
No problem.
All right, that's it. That's literally it.
All right, shall we move on to the conclusion?
Yeah. So, Dan, final thoughts. Really, what I want to direct your final thoughts.
That's fine. I don't care
about
that.
Is this the first Gundam you show someone?
And I have a definitive answer for you. I do.
I said earlier, we said this on the Reddit, and it caused a flame war. And now that we've rewatched it, second time through, we've seen 00 very recently, the other, like, iconic leading example for first Gundam to make people watch.
Yes.
All right, Dan, is this the best beginner Gundam?
It is most definitely the best beginner Gundam. with all its faults, I think that actually adds to making it the best beginner Gundam. Because if you watch 1 through 50 of IBO and you went, I like that. You went, that's cool. I'd like to see more. Then you're in. You're fine. Because it's not like the best of the best of the best in the sense that like it is an immaculate perfect thing. Because then it's hard to show other stuff compared to that, right? It's like, well, you can watch 00, but it's worth, you know what I'm saying? I think 00 is much more political in a way that is a turnoff. There's like actual real geopolitics in 00, right? And some people don't like that. But this is sort of just like kind of made up fake politics. And there's not that much of it. And I think that makes it more acceptable. Now, I think if you make the argument you need to get someone into UC, I think UC is basically inaccessible. And if you recommend a UC show to someone as your first time, you're stupid. Full stop. But if you were to recommend a UC show to someone, boy, that's tough. It would either be F91 because it's sort of standalone, even though it's not that great of a movie, or Thunderbolt only because it's new and good looking and is sort of self-contained.
Thunderbolt's very standalone.
Yeah, you can say these guys are good, these guys are bad, but they're both kind of bad, they're both kind of good, and people go, I don't care about who Zeon or the Earth Federation is. You can just sort of watch
it. It's so Star Warsy. You're like, here's the Rebellion, here's the Empire, that sort of conflict. You're like, here's two people fighting.
But
that's the only setup you need for Thunderbolt.
My issue with both of those shows as well is that F91 sort of is completely irrelevant to the rest of UC, and Thunderbolt is so drastically different in theming and tone that if you show them 0079 after that, they'll go, what the heck is this? This is like a kid's show, and I just watched like a rated R movie, you know? So anyhow, that is why IBO is the best beginner Gundam.
All right. My recommendation, absolutely nuclear take. I don't think you're ready for this. Best way to get someone into Gundam, the franchise, is to get them the 10, just or own them yourself, the 10 hardcover volumes of Mobile Suit Gundam The Origin by Yoshikazu Yasuhiko. It may not be an anime, but I think it's undeniable this is the best way to experience 0079.
It is, most definitely. Oh, for sure.
It is by far and away. It's like extremely well drawn, well written, well translated. Like it's high production value. That's not a concern. It's extremely cogent. Like, it fixes every possible plot hole with 0079. It retcons Char's history into oblivion so that it makes perfect sense. All of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's UC, the beginning of UC.
Yes.
So they never, if they are not someone who can handle that 1979 sweet animation, they never have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They can instead go straight into Zeta, which is still a gorgeous show, in my opinion.
Yes.
And the best Gundam anime. And I think it gets Origin does get everything that makes Gundam good. It's got good fight scenes, cool mech designs, good politics, interesting characters. It retains all of that. Of course, some people hate reading. That is the biggest downside.
Who are those people?
Like, I have to read the Origin.
I don't know who those people exist.
But it's really legit. It's extremely good.
It is.
And I think you're not going to show them any other piece of Gundam media that will make them want to experience it more than that. Like, make them be like, I need more Gundam. Specifically Gundam, not just, like, cool, edgy action shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you're going to have another better intro material to help someone transition to Universal Century.
I agree, because as I said, I think Universal Century is basically inaccessible at this point.
That said, this is a bit of a cop-out answer, because it means I don't have to pick the best Gundam anime to show someone. Because you cannot show them Gundam The Origin OVAs, because those do not follow the manga, because they only cover the material that's not in 0079 originally.
Exactly. You go, hey, why are we paying attention to these little kids hanging out on this colony?
Yeah, and why do we, who's, like, who's Ramba Rawl's dad? I forget their name.
Jimba.
Jimba Rawl.
Yeah, like, you don't need to know who Jimba Rawl is at all.
No, but if you're just reading the comic in the manga, you're just like, oh, yeah, I want to know about Jimba Rawl, because you've already read Volume 3, Ramba Rawl, and you're like, yeah, I want to know more about this dude. Right? Exactly. They do a really good job of hooking you in and, like, streamlining that story. So, unfortunately, I was really hoping for the 40th anniversary they would announce that they would extend the origin to cover all of, like, the manga material. Of course, they did not. So we don't have that. So the only way for someone who's only watches anime is to experience 0079 is to watch 0079, which is such a hurdle for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is really tough.
I know so many people are like, just suck it up if you can't handle it, like, whatever. But listen, folks, not everyone has terrible mech brain like we do, and people who listen to this podcast.
They can't handle this. We're cursed.
The fact of the matter is that our brains have decayed because we've seen too much of this, and our standard for what is watchable is so different than your average anime fan.
That is exactly my point. Where you talk to these entitled Gundam fans, and you go, "Yeah, you're right." You go, "What do you watch?" They go, "Just watch it in UC order." It's like, that's not possible. You can't do that in the year 2020. You can't do that.
You cannot introduce someone who has never seen a Gundam before and just go, just watch 0079.
Yeah, you're delusional. You're absolutely delusional if you say that. That's why, like,
I think if you are speaking to someone who's already got anime brain and, like, you know, they're like, I love Hokuto no Ken, then you can say, watch 0079.
That's true.
But that person doesn't need an introduction to Gundam. They'll get there themselves. If you've got a buddy who, especially in the context of Iron Blooded Orphans, is like, dude, I loved Attack on Titan Season 3, and I know that you're into Gundam. What's a Gundam to watch, right? I want to watch something that you watch so that we can talk about it, or, you know.
Yeah.
Just basically how I got into Gundam is my friends bugged me about it enough times, and I was like, I don't know, these model kits look pretty cool. Like, yeah. I think then you're in a really tough situation, and if they only want to watch anime because they only watch Kimetsu, you know, Yaiba or whatever, like, then... probably IBO, because I think it's the one that is the most graspable to a modern American anime fan.
Yeah.
Who's only into anime casually, they'll just be like, oh, I get these characters and what's happening. Even 00 has moments where you're just like, huh?
Exactly.
And the really worst parts of IBO, episodes 6 through 15 of season 2, which is the mobile armor diversion terrible stuff, even that is like, fine, it's not the desert in 0079, right? Like, it could be worse.
Yeah, and it's still,
it's not like the
cool
weird
moments.
10 episodes of 00 where nothing happens, like,
yeah, I for sure. And the worst part is we're getting old. 00 is getting a little not dated, but it's getting old.
I think the problem is new anime right now looks so good that people want something like that, and even 00 is starting to, like, 00 is in an unfortunate spot where you can go back and watch Stardust Memory, and it will always look good.
Oh, yeah.
And you can go back and watch 0080, and it will look good. Yeah. You can go back and watch Zeta, and it will look good. But you go back too far, like to 79, and you're like, ugh. And you go back not far enough, and you get the weird mixed stuff. Like, 00's coloring doesn't quite work as well.
Or look at Seed. Gundam Seed is like, oh.
Yeah, that stuff just doesn't translate as much anymore. Yeah. So you need to either go further back or hit them with something that they can recognize immediately, and that's IBO.
Yeah.
So, all right. Anyway, that's our discussion of Best Beginner Gundam. At us. Please at us and get mad at us.
At us and tell me why I'm 100% correct, you fools.
I completely maintain that Gundam the Origin, the manga, is the only way to experience Gundam for the first time.
I mean, you could do Build Divers, but whatever.
A fan of the show, Chris, wrote in a really nice email around the time of New Year's and had a recommended segment idea, which is at the end of every time we finish a show to just, like, maybe list off something to watch after this. Like, if you were a big IBO fan, you really liked this, and you're looking for something to watch, do you have, Dan and me, like, a recommendation for something to, like, maybe go watch next?
00? I'm just kidding.
I know. It is weird that those two are linked. I was trying to think of maybe something we hadn't already covered, but, and I also told him in the email, I'm like, I think the problem is we're just going to recommend Gunbuster every week, but.
Oh! I think about Gunbuster way more often than any human should. Dang. I can't do this off the cuff. So next
yeah,
time
I should
we
have
do,
warned you.
Yeah.
For me, my first thought here was, like, Code Geass. Like, if you were into IBO and you want to go a little further back, I think you could do Code Geass.
Oh, Ian, are we maybe going to watch Code Geass soon?
It'll happen eventually. It's long though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Next time we do something, I will put something in the bank for that.
Yeah, but I think that'll be a recurring segment. I like it as an idea, and it'll happen every time we finish off a show or movie or something. Of course, okay. If we watch like Pat Labor 2, our recommendation is going to be like watch Pat Labor 3. So
yeah, right. It's a little tough when it's like that, but yeah, that's a good idea.
So even though we missed a week and so on, I have not been not recording, and we have two bonus episodes, two like extra weird episodes that are going before we resume our regular programming.
Oh, thank you
Next
so much.
Next week
Ian.
Is a session that I recorded over Christmas with some friends of the show of us playing Macross 2, the RPG from 1983. It's pretty short. It's pretty goofy. I might record a bit of a pre-intro just of the tape so I can explain some of the rules before we get into it, but it's a good time. The week after that is going to be my long-delayed episode about Promare, which I saw in theaters when it was doing its re-release in December. So I'm going to talk about Promare, and I'm going to talk about when I saw Shar's Counterattack in theaters. And then the week after that is back with the Ian and Dan show, and we're going to be watching Pat Labor Movie 2.
Hooray! Because we like so Pat Labor Movie the one a lot.
Pat Labor Movie 1, I was thinking recently, actually, I was like, what movie do I show a science fiction fan that has robots that I think they could watch and, like, get? Like, what mecha movie would you show a science fiction fan as an introduction to mecha?
Pat Labor Movie Love, 1 is a pretty good...
Well, I was thinking, it's either Do You Remember Love or Pat Labor Movie 1, because Pat Labor Movie 1 is, like, the first, like, hour and a half of it is, like, pure detective science fiction movie. It's pretty relatable.
No, I actually agree with you. I think the Pat Labor movie actually does that much better. Much, much better. Yeah. And is more watchable.
I'm really looking forward to that. So, finally, this is it. If you want to reach out to us and tell us all about how terrible our choices were for the first Gundam to watch, you can reach us at mechadoaboutnothing@gmail.com. That's the name of the podcast at gmail.com. Our website is mechado.moe, and our Twitter account is @mechadoopodcast. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Ian.
Until next week, will you be able to survive?